Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast from iHeart and RadioMD. Thanks for listening. Download us every week. We have new episodes, new guests every week, talking to you about the latest medical news, but much more importantly, what it means for you so that you can live at the top of your curve for a very long time. We have a great guest for you today, and she has to be a great guest because her name is Dr. Blank, and I'll bet she got teased an awful lot in medical school at UC San Diego. She went from East Coast Yale to San Diego, back to the East Coast to Cornell, then to Penn, where my son is, obviously, is a faculty member, and now has settled in at Mount Sinai at the Icahn School. So we're really appreciative for Dr. Blank coming on. She's going to talk to us about a very tough subject to talk to us about, that is ovarian cancer. Tough because it's tough to figure out what to do early enough because the symptoms are tough to diagnose and tough, if you will, to do the appropriate tests on. So we're going to, our first question to her is there going to be a blood test for ovarian cancer? We know that the CA-125 was there. It doesn't work very well. What's next in this? Is there a lot of stuff new coming on? Dr. Blank from Mount Sinai.
Thank you, and thank you for everything you've said. And yes, I was teased a little bit growing up, but I've gotten used to it. So in terms of is there going to be a blood test for ovarian cancer, I mean, that is the holy grail. I think that you are absolutely right that we've been looking at a couple of different things here and there, as well as ultrasound, and we have not yet been, you know, not yet hit the jackpot as yet, but I do feel that we are getting closer. Now, it's very hard to do the proper tests, to design the proper studies to confirm that these things actually work, and that's part of the issue that we have because you need a lot of follow-up, and these studies take a long time. Recently, about 2 years ago, there was actually a lot of excitement about a study that came out of England that was looking at ultrasound and CA-125. And I don't know if you remember this in the news, there was some excitement, but then there was some debate as to whether the excitement was really justified. Anyway, I'm going to answer your question with a really cop-out answer, which is going to be, I do think there will be something. We're not there yet.
And now, one of the other questions, we tweeted about you being here and someone with a history, a family history of ovarian cancer, who has not had her ovaries out. She has BRCA, I think one or two, I don't know which, but did do bilateral breast reductions or mastectomies. And she said, will the ultrasound be cheap enough, be developed enough, be able to be used easily enough that I can put one on my iPhone and learn how to do it myself? So she says, will I learn how to do this myself?
Yeah.
And will it be available, or can I send it to someone periodically? And so it's a doable test that isn't outrageously expensive, but that I can do or someone else can do on a home app. And when will that be available?
I'm going to say I wouldn't count on that too soon, because even the ones done by, like, the best experts in the world at this point in time, not that we just don't know. But even those that are done by people that do, this is the only thing they do, we have not yet been able to confirm that they're helpful. I mean, that would be a great thing, but I suspect it would be something, if that is to happen, I think quicker really would be something that would be more molecular, less kind of dependent on the person doing it, if you will, because ultrasound's not that easy to do.
And so what do we do? What are the presenting? So we've skipped ahead, and I apologize to our audience for skipping ahead, but ovarian cancer is so tough to treat it because you often diagnose it late. So why do we diagnose it late? What's the difference between it and, for example, a brain tumor? And why do we diagnose these so late? And what can be done to help us diagnose it earlier?
Okay, that's like a six-part question, but I'll do my best.
This is a multiple choice question.
Those are great questions. I think, first of all, the main difference between a brain cancer, say, and an ovarian cancer is any small change in the brain you notice instantaneously. In the ovary, it's sort of sitting in a big cavity, and it can grow a little bit or change a little bit, and it doesn't really cause symptoms that much. I think that the issue with ovarian cancer is that the symptoms are really nonspecific. They're things that every woman, or actually every person, has at some point in their life. So if you have a symptom like constipation or something like that, you're not instantaneously going to say, oh, this is ovarian cancer, the way, you know, if you couldn't see, I'm just making something up, if you couldn't see out of one of your eyes, or if you, you know, turned yellow all of a sudden, you would say, oh, I have this, a different type of cancer. So there's not one hallmark symptom. There's not a good screening test, which we just alluded to before, but that's a huge thing in that we really are not able to pick ovarian cancer up sort of at its when it's like in its nascent phases. We don't know what it looks like before it turns into cancer. Something like the Pap smear, and of course I always just like to stress that the Pap smear has nothing to do with the detection of ovarian cancer, but the Pap smear, we know about the changes that occur in the cervix before things turn into cancer, but we don't have that information. We don't know about that for ovary.
So women present with this disease with what symptoms? Do they have any? Do they have bleeding? Do they have bloating? What do they have?
Yeah, they do have. I mean, initially it used to be referred to as the silent killer, which is a sort of a terrible thing to say, but it used to be just thought to be completely silent. But a lot of work was done, and it was actually determined when people looked back that they did, in fact, have symptoms. And some of the main ones, bloating, as you mentioned, constipation, pelvic pain, and sort of urinary changes. Some say frequency, urgency, or things like that. Those are some of the main ones. Not necessarily bleeding, and you know, a lot of things that you might think of being symptoms of ovarian cancer. Not necessarily, like bleeding, for example, is one that you just mentioned.
And now the therapies. So I assume they don't just get big locally, but they start spreading. Just
yeah.
Like any other tumor, and that's the problem, is that by the time we know about them, they've started to spread in a disproportionately high case because we don't have the symptoms.
Yes, exactly. And one, you know, if ovary cancer is picked up when it is confined to the ovary, hasn't spread at all, it can actually be curable, something you don't think about with ovarian cancer. But once it's spread, you know, it isn't necessarily. And that's one thing that's a big, you know, what makes ovarian cancer a good cancer for us to learn to pick up early, because it the outcome changes so much if it is picked up early.
More with Dr. Michael Roizen and the You, the Owner's Manual podcast coming up. Here's the deal. To truly thrive in all areas of your life, you cannot ignore the importance of good health. I've learned this firsthand, and for many of us, time is our most valuable asset. This is why I love Organifi Green Juice, an organic superfood green juice powder you just add water to get your greens anytime, anywhere, without the mess. Plus, you can now enjoy Organifi Red Juice Powder too. When you invest in your health, you gain more time because you have more energy and focus to get through your day. The best thing about Organifi Green and Red Juice is that it actually tastes good. Try it for yourself. Use the code U, Y-O-U, at Organifi.com. That's Organifi.com. Once again, use the code U, that's Y-O-U, to receive 20% off your order at Organifi.com. And You, the Owner's Manual podcast is brought to you by Memory Rescue, the brand new book that can help you with your memory. Let's hear from its author.
Hi, I'm Dr. Daniel Amen, author of a new book called Memory Rescue. Memory Rescue teaches you how to prevent future problems, but if you're having memory problems now, how to rescue it, how to get it back so that everything in your life can be better. Plant the habits that I talk in your life. I know it'll make a dramatic difference for you and for those you love.
It's important that you receive this information. Get your copy of Memory Rescue by Dr. Daniel Amen. Learn more at memoryrescuebook.com. That's memoryrescuebook.com. And now back to Dr. Michael Roizen and the You, the Owner's Manual podcast.
We're talking with Dr. Stephanie Blank. She is Director of Women's Health, the Mount Sinai Downtown Chelsea Center, Professor of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Now, there are other gynecologic cancers. Talk to us a little bit about the changes in the pap smear indications and if you will, what else is done with pap smears or in place of pap smears now?
Okay. So I think you might be alluding to some recent reports from the U.S. Preventative Health Service Task Force. I might have messed that up a little bit, which recently came out and got a bit of media. Basically, traditionally there was one way to screen for cervical cancer, and that was through a pap smear, which is basically scraping some cells off the surface of the cervix and looking at them under the microscope. Subsequently, we learned that you can use both cytology or pap smear along with HPV or human papillomavirus testing, and you can actually improve sort of the how predictive your testing is of not only current but future. Now, the thing about HPV testing currently is that it's a little bit of more of a one step thing. So if you do a pap smear, somebody has to take the pap smear and somebody has to read the pap smear. HPV testing, you kind of take the, you know, you get the sample and it goes to a sign, you know, to it get just gets run and it's a yes or a no thing. There's not different shades of gray the way they are with pap smears. So, you know, for a while now, since the early 2000s, there's been some decent evidence that you should use both pap smear plus what's called co-testing, HPV testing at the same time, to basically triage women that come for their pap smears. By using these two things instead of one thing, what's sort of happened is that the interval between pap smears has actually been able to be spread out. So instead of having to have pap smears every year for women over the age of 30, it can now be every 3 years if everything is actually normal. So that's a change. Now, I'm going on. I'm sorry. Am I talking too much?
No, you're doing perfectly. Don't okay. Stop. You're really being very informative.
Okay, good. Then what recently came out from the U.S., the Preventative Health Services Task Force, is they were recommending doing away all the way with the pap smear and actually just doing HPV testing in women over the age of 30. And there is some debate among people in the field about whether it's too soon to really do that, because it took a really long time for, you know, regular OBGYNs and family doctors to kind of adopt the newer screening, which is the co-testing, and now just basically to drop something they've been using for a long time. There's a little bit of debate as to whether or not that's a good plan. And additionally, the five-year interval was really based on modeling, not on, like, clinical data. So I think that some of the experts in the field are sort of saying, even if we're going to move to frontline HPV testing, let's not go for 5 years. Let's do 3 years. But those are some of the sort of things that are being said.
We're talking to Dr. Stephanie Blank, Director of Women's Health at Mount Sinai Downtown Chelsea Center in New York. She is of the ICON School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital. Before I ask her another question, because I've got some what I think are important questions for all of us, I want to talk to find out from Radio MD's Bill Klaproth about this episode's sponsor. Bill? Thanks very much, Bill, and thank you for thinking about our sponsors as well. We're talking with Dr. Stephanie Blank. She has no relationship to our sponsors, but does have a relationship with the ICON School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She is the Director of Women's Health at the Mount Sinai Downtown Chelsea Center and a professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences there. So when one gets a diagnosis of a cancer, one does what we call staging of it, which means where is it and how risky is it for us? What's the message on that?
In terms of staging for ovarian cancer
or other cancers?
So I guess specifically I'll start with ovarian since we were talking about that before, but importantly, staging is really important. If women with suspected ovarian cancer or known ovarian cancer are treated by somebody who is specially trained in the management of women with ovarian cancer, a gynecologic oncologist, they will actually do better. And part of the reason for that is because they are properly staged if they are managed by somebody who deals with this cancer. The staging has to be done really surgically. You can't tell with your eyes or by imaging if something has spread. So staging is extremely important with ovarian cancer. It's actually important with a lot of different cancers, as you alluded to. I think one important thing with ovarian cancer, actually with others as well, but is that different stages of cancer are treated so vastly differently that having that information is extremely important.
The stages go up in seriousness or worse prognosis. Is that right? In other words, stage 3 is worse than stage 2 is worse than stage 1.
Correct.
And talk to us a little bit about the staging of ovarian cancer. Is there, in other words, what is stage 3 mean? What's the prognosis of that versus stage 1?
Sure. So, the stage basically is the number to represent if it's spread beyond certain, stage 1 would be just the ovary, stage 2, and there's like subsets within here, would be in the pelvis, stage 3 would be to the upper abdomen, and stage 4 would be to sort of distant places, the lung or the liver or something like that. And the prognosis is worse with a higher stage. Stage 1 and 2 being sort of considered earlier stage, and 3 and 4 later stage, but there are some 2s that are sort of should probably be grouped with the higher stage. So it's not as much, I wouldn't say necessarily that 4 is significantly worse than, a 3C, but there's sort of early and advanced. Another thing in there that is a big predictor of how people do is how, if all their disease can be removed with surgery. So, a stage 4 cancer patient that can have everything removed will do better than a stage 3 patient that can't have everything removed.
Now, with breast cancer, we've learned that lifestyle makes a huge difference in recurrence rates. That is, when you get the breast cancer out, if you lower your body mass index into the normal range, you decrease your risk, if you had a body mass index of 33, by 50% of a recurrence. If you have olive oil as your main fat and do 2 fruits and vegetables a day plus 30 minutes of physical activity, you decrease your 10-year recurrence rate by 92%. Do we have any such data like that on ovarian cancer and how important lifestyle is?
Well, I think there's a large study ongoing looking at this. I think, I would love to have data as solid as that you just, recited there. I think the reasons that probably the same reasons for which having lifestyle changes are effective in breast cancer will probably ring true as well for ovarian cancer, but we don't have those same sets of data specific for ovarian cancer as yet.
Now we should say that you, as a hobby, are a runner. Is that correct?
I love to run. Thank you. Yes.
And thank you. So anything else you want to tell us as a parting word from Dr. Stephanie Blank? She is the Director of Women's Health at the Chelsea Health Center for Icon. I'm missing this, if you will, so you may have to help me, for the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai University. And she's a professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive science there. So you have heard someone who is obviously very skilled, a very exceptional communicator, as well as a great doc, I will bet, who's been talking to us. Stephanie Blank, anything you want to tell our listeners? Probably 80% of them are female. It's kind of like the distribution of caregivers at a hospital. 80% are female, and many of them are in the vulnerable ages for ovarian cancer. What do you tell them?
So I would say, if something's not right with your body, don't just write it off to eating too much or not sleeping enough. Do see your doctor, and if you're not satisfied with the response that your doctor gives you, just see a different doctor. I think, on the same subject, if you have a family history, it is worth exploring. Getting genetic testing can be extremely valuable information and can actually save your life if you act on the results. And since we're talking about gynecologic cancers, the HPV vaccine prevents cervical cancer. It's a completely preventable disease. I'll stop talking right now, but I hope this was helpful.
There's a quick question from my associate here who heard your statement. She's 62. She has not had the HPV vaccine, doesn't have HPV, but she recently lost her husband and is thinking about becoming sexually active. Should she get the HPV vaccine?
It's really only approved for people up to age 27. I don't think it's a problem, but I don't think she necessarily has to have it. If she wanted to do it, there would be no harm, but at present it's really for preteens.
Thanks very much to Dr. Stephanie Blank from the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai University. You've been listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, the show that helps you understand medicine, take control of your body so you can live at the top of your curve. What you heard Dr. Stephanie Blank say to us was something really important. If your body isn't feeling right to you, seek help, and don't stop if someone dismisses it. Keep going to other doctors till you find out what's right. Oprah did that, and she's happy. She did it. You can do it, too. It doesn't require that you're as rich as Oprah to be able to keep going to doctor and doctor until you get the right answer for you. Be persistent. Thanks very much, Dr. Stephanie Blank. Randall, thanks for great engineering as well. Thank you, our listeners, for downloading the podcast. Please download every week. This is 860. I think, Randall, this is 864C. Download us, rate us, and write us at ageprooflife@gmail.com to ask us what guests to have. Thanks very much. We'll be back next week with a new best medical news of the week that you can take charge of your body with, as well as another guest or two. Thanks again.